Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is someone I've admired for a long time, and that is James Altucher. The way he's able to write, the way he's able to storytell, the way he's able to put his heart on the line in order for the reader to experience a connection with him in that moment, it is incredible to watch, incredible to read, and I'm extremely grateful that James decided to come on the podcast and was able to bring that same forthright energy into this conversation. He was so vulnerable. He was so honest. We talked at length about his article, New York City Being Dead, and how that still weighs on him to this day. And then, because James has been a role model of mine as a writer for so long, for him to have a familiarity with my story and recognize me at the end of this conversation, that meant the world to me. And it was so cool to witness. And this conversation was one I will treasure and look back on for sure. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. And I really hope that it leaves some sort of lasting imprint on you. If you have any thoughts or feedback about this episode, as always, let me know on Twitter at Hey Danny Miranda, and please share it with someone you think will enjoy it as well, whether that's an Instagram post or a tweet. Just share it with someone or some people you think will enjoy it. So without further ado, this is my conversation with James Altucher.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
James, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you. I've been a longtime fan, and I'm excited to dive into your story today. Thank you for being here.
Danny, thanks for having me on the show. I'm really grateful you asked me to come on.
Of course, have to. So I'd like to start off with you at college. You graduate college, and the first thing you do, I believe, is you work in an IT department for HBO. Can you tell us exactly how that happened?
Yeah, so what happened was I graduated college, and I graduated in 3 years because I didn't want to take out any more loans. And so I kind of, anyway, then I went to graduate school in computer science and I got thrown out. Like, I was not a good student. I went to a really good graduate school and I was the dumbest person there and I failed every class. And I was also interested in other things. You could only really pursue things that you're interested in. And I lost interest and I got interested in writing and in other things. And so finally they wrote me a letter saying, look, you have to leave, but when you're mature enough, you can come back. And I've never been able to go back. And so I took a job at HBO, and that was, I was doing work in graduate school on like virtual reality type stuff. And HBO thought maybe they would get some of that if I went there. But I got to HBO and I knew nothing. Like they... You know, I had been programming in the academic world, like at college and in graduate school. I knew nothing about what it meant to be a software person in the real world. And I was, again, the worst person there. They had to send, after 5 years of undergraduate and then graduate school doing programming, I had to go to remedial programming classes to just survive at a very basic level at my first corporate job. But I loved HBO. The whole reason I wanted to work there is I loved watching HBO. And I remember at the time, J.P. Morgan offered me a job for double the salary that HBO was offering. And this was back in 1994. And in New York City, HBO offered $40,000 a year, which is not enough. Wasn't enough then to live in New York City. And it's definitely not enough now to live in New York City. And J.P. Morgan offered about $82,000. And I took the HBO job because, again, life's short, and I loved watching HBO, and I didn't know anything about like banks or anything like that, so I took the HBO job, and it really changed my life. I convinced them to make a website. No one was making websites then, and I knew how to make a website, and people saw that website and they liked it, and that started me on an entrepreneurial path where at night I was making websites for other entertainment companies and charging them a lot more than I was making at HBO, and by day I was working at HBO.
I want to go to the taking the $40,000 job versus the $82,000 job, because it seems like you had a calling toward it or loved it. What advice would you give to someone who's picking between two jobs and is thinking about the money versus the love or the passion?
It's a really good question, because on the one hand, if for various reasons they really feel they need the money, then, you know, like maybe they're married with kids and have a mortgage or whatever, then you got to do what you got to do. But I would strongly suggest trying to overlap your interests and passions as much as you can with your the way you make money. And that doesn't matter whether you're 20 years old, all the way up to 60 years old or whatever. Like, you can always monetize. There's always some way to monetize what you're passionate about. So I was passionate even then about writing and about entertainment. And I just thought HBO was so creative, the way their shows were, you know, their original content. They were the first cable company to do really original content. That's kind of their claim to fame. And I knew that sooner or later they would let me do things that were more creative than, not that computer programming is not creative, but I wanted to create content. Like, I was on the side, I was writing novels and doing things like that. So at one point, I just walked to the CEO's office, and his name's Jeff Bukas. He was eventually the CEO of Time Warner until they sold to, I think Verizon or AT&T. And I went to Jeff Bukas' office and I said, look, just like HBO does original TV shows, I want to do original web shows. And he said, whatever, I don't give a shit. And so I went back to my boss, who was a little, at first he was upset. Like, I went to his boss's boss to get permission to do this. So he was a little upset at me of going over his head. Like, you can't break the etiquette in corporate environments. But I said, Jeff Bukas wants us to do this. I included him in it. And he said, okay. And so I had a lot of fun doing like an original web show. I called it 3 a.m. I was interviewing people at 3 in the morning in New York City. What were they up to? And they were not up to anything good in most cases. And that also helped me when I started my company making websites. I was that guy who was doing all this creative stuff at HBO, and so everybody wanted to hire me. So it was me and my brother-in-law, and nobody in the city. There was like five people in New York City at that time who knew how to do a website. So we were doing jobs like AmericanExpress.com and TimeWarner.com and ConEdison.com, which was the big utility company. And then we did all the record labels. Like, we were doing, you know, all every hip-hop record label. So Loud Records, Bad Boy Records, Jive Records, Death Row Records, Interscope. We were doing all the record labels, doing movie studios. It was a lot of fun, but, you know, I knew it was that bubble was going to burst at some point. Not the internet bubble, but the bubble of nobody knowing how to make a website. Like, we would charge an enormous amount of money to make a website because there was no supply of people who knew how to make it other than us and a handful of other people. So that was I knew nothing about business. I didn't really want to be an entrepreneur, but I was really afraid that if things didn't work out at HBO, I'd have no backup plan. And it really started, I was just trying to help my brother-in-law with his business, and I showed him this thing, the web, and that's how we got started.
Where does the confidence come from to go to the CEO of the company, even though that's your boss's 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 boss? Where does that confidence come from to just go to him and pitch him an idea? Because a lot of people would have the idea but wouldn't have the execution to actually pitch.
I think you have to ask yourself, it wasn't necessarily confidence. Like, sometimes I'm confident and sometimes I'm not. But you have to ask yourself, what's the downside if you do this? And also, what's the downside if you don't do it? Like, the entire reason I wanted to work at HBO was to somehow get involved in entertainment. And by the way, this 3 a.m. idea, eventually they did give me a budget to shoot a pilot for it for TV. And so I kind of achieved, to some extent, my dream, exactly what I intended to. But The downside of not going to Jeff was that I would just be this IT guy who was working on the website, and eventually they would get other people to kind of supply all the content. And that's what's since happened, since, you know, I left there in 1997, but it basically just became a marketing brochure after that. And now, of course, it's a streaming service. But, you know, I don't necessarily know if I was confident, except there was no downside. What was he going to do, fire me? And I guess my boss could have gotten mad at me, but I had enough clout at that point because I was the only one who could make the HBO's website. I kind of had a feeling they weren't. I mean, I would literally work on HBO's website during the day, but sometimes I'd have to lock myself in a conference room and take calls from American Express when they were having problems with their website, or, you know, take calls from, like, you know, Puff Daddy's number two guy when they were having problems with their website. And people are banging on the conference room door, and I'm trying to walk, you know, Bad Boy Records, head of internet, you know, through their website and how to plug in her computer and all this stuff. So it was really stressful, kind of juggling two things. And eventually, what happened was I needed help making the website, so I hired my own company when I was at HBO to make HBO.com. And so HBO was so impressed, they wanted to buy my company, but they didn't know it was my company. And so I had to tell them, and then they were like, they still couldn't really fire me, but they were like, okay, just maybe we'll still use you, but maybe just simplify this and just go to your company full time. And then I became full time at my company. But, you know, that's how things, everybody was win-win-win for everybody, even though it seems a little under the radar, but what can you do?
How were you the only person who knew how to make a website basically at that time?
Well, there were a couple of people. There was like three or four companies that knew how. But when I was at grad school, when the web first rolled out, you know, out of Tim Berners-Lee, you know, at CERN, there's only a few universities that were given web servers, the first web servers. So MIT, Stanford, and I was going to grad school at Carnegie Mellon University. Those were like the first three. There was only like a handful of websites. So I would made my personal page, and it was all text. There was no images. And I really loved writing, so I would post my short stories on it. And the web was like small enough that like random people from all over the place were like reading these short stories I wrote. And, you know, it was this great thing. And also, it was nobody knew where it was going to go. We didn't know it was going to be this huge commercial platform. Like, I kind of thought it was going to be like this artistic thing where hypertext, you know, even saying hypertext, it's like an antique word. It's the H of HTML, but you know, or it's the HT. No, it's just the H. And nobody knew what it was going to be, but I got obsessed with it. And you know, I just all the time was learning all the latest programming techniques for it. And so that came in very valuable when I started this company. And, you know, it's in general, you want to kind of be a little bit ahead of the crowd, you know, like Danny, what you're doing with NFTs. NFTs are probably we're not even in inning one yet, because we're in that state the internet was in, but the web was in like from 1995 through 1998, where it was starting to be commercial, but people couldn't tell whether it was a fad or whether it was real. You know, I remember one time, so I had after all this was happening, I started a venture capital firm after I sold my business. And one of my partners in it was a banker. He didn't know anything about the internet, but he was a good investment banker. And when the internet crashed in 2001, I remember one time, it was the last time I saw him. We were playing the arcade game Defender in my office, and he lost, and he took out all his frustration. He, like, you know, punched the screen and broke it, and he said, "The internet's a goddamn fad." And then he walked out, and I never saw him again.
So what can we learn? Because these cycles of the internet is seemingly going to happen over and over and over again. People get really excited about a new technology. Then there's a bunch of money that gets poured into it. Then it collapses in some respect. But the technology proves to be correct long-term. So what can we learn and take away from that for future technologies? What can I take away from that going to NFTs in the future?
Yeah, NFTs, and let's just say cryptocurrency in general, because sure, they're all part of the same rise and fall. I admit NFTs are different than crypto the way e-commerce is different than the web, but they all kind of rise and fall together. Yeah. And that's a great question. Like, I think one thing is learn everything. If you're a believer and you love doing it, like I loved being on the web, not necessarily the internet, which was a little different, but the web I thought was like this ingenious thing. So I learned everything I could about it. So that's why when a company like American Express needed a website, they went to Arthur Andersen, the biggest accounting firm at that time in the world, now since gone out of business. Arthur Andersen didn't know how to do it. They went to a huge ad agency. The ad agency didn't know how to do it. They went to a consulting firm that was like a tech consulting firm. They didn't know how to do it. So they went to just me and my brother-in-law. And we charged $250,000. I was making $40,000 a year. We charged $250,000 to make this website. Wow. But I was stupid. I'll tell you how I was stupid. Is that I created all this software. It was a huge website. So I created all this software to help me make websites. But I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell American Express that that's what I had done. So it looked like we made this 30,000-page website just manually. And then years later, of course, there's things like WordPress and other tools to make huge websites. I didn't know. I didn't understand business at the time. Like, I didn't know that providing a product is much more scalable than providing a service, because I was making $250,000. I never had more than $2,000 in my bank account, and suddenly I was charging this kind of money. I figured, well, better to be profitable than not profitable. That was my thinking, which was stupid, and I didn't realize that you know, if I had created a scalable product, and I was all the time, I was making software to help me build the websites we were building. I had like a whole suite of products we could have rebranded ourselves as like a software company. Instead, we were a services company, and service companies are valued at much less. I still made money. There was a bubble, but could have made, you know, some of my peers, all of my peers were making a shitload of money. Like, you know, the guy in the office next to me at graduate school, he made one of the first search engines, sold it for $2 billion. So it's Lycos. Another guy sold another company for $40 million. What did he do? It allowed you to auction keywords on a search engine. So like everybody in my school knew everything about the internet. And I was like, nah, I just want to have cash in the bank and I'll write a novel. And I didn't care that much about money, but maybe I should have understood. I should have learned a little bit more about what business is and how people value things. And, you know, there are skills to business. There are skills to programming. There are skills to Bitcoin. There are skills for the web. So I should have learned every domain I was in. I should have learned the skill set instead of just relying on, oh, well, I know how to program this better than anyone else. The other thing is it more generally about, you know, how do we learn from these rise and falls? Nobody knows what's going to be a success. We have no idea. Like, everybody says, okay, Cardano, buy that. Solano, buy that. We honestly don't have a clue. Like again, that's why in 2001, 10 years after the first web server was made, you know, my business partner at the time said, the whole thing's a fad. Like, he still didn't know. And right now we're 10 years after, or a little more than that now, 12 years after Bitcoin was first made. People are still saying it's a fad, it's this, it's that. So, you know, take Google as an example. I'll give you a little story. I was at my venture capital firm. An associate who worked for me came up to me and said, listen, a friend of mine has this company and it's about to go out of business. And I'm like, well, what is it? He said, we could buy half of this company for $1 million, for nothing, in VC terms. And it seems like it's an interesting business. And I'm like, well, what do they do? And he said, well, they do stuff with search engines. And I'm like, oh, search engines, not a single search engine makes money. Like, they're all going out of business. Lycos, Excite, InfoSeek, they're all going out of business. So I don't want to do it. So pass. Well, 6 months later, Google bought this company for 1% of Google. They gave them stock, 1% of Google. The company was Applied Semantics, which became 99% of Google's revenues. That is the search ranking system for auctioning off keywords. So it's all of the SEO stuff that Google does. So I didn't know. I passed on that opportunity. And Facebook, who would have known? Like, MySpace already had like 100 million users and was just bought for $500 million. Who would have known that MySpace was going to almost instantly disappear and Facebook was going to have billions of users? So nobody knows. Like, a great example is this one guy made a platform, and this was like in 2004, 2005, he made a platform for doing podcasts. This was like long before podcasts, and he had no customers. There was no podcast then. And this one employee sitting in the corner was off making his own little software project in his spare time. He wanted to basically SMS people through the web and let those SMS texts kind of stay on the site, and he called it Twitter. And so Ev Williams, who started this podcasting company, I forget the name of the original company, he told all his investors, listen, we're shutting down all the podcasting stuff, and we're focusing on this new project, Twitter. It's got a couple thousand users. Seems interesting. But he said, I will give back everybody's money if you want your money back. Whoever wants their money back, I will buy you out and take your shares. So 100% of the investors didn't want to be involved, and they all backed out. These are the best investors on the planet right now. And
not Mike Maples. You say 100%. Mike Maples is one that got that call and said, I'll invest in you. But most of them did, I'm sure. And I only say that because Mike Maples just came on the podcast.
Was he in the original group of investors that invested in the podcasting platform?
Yes.
Oh, I'm pretty sure. I thought, because Ev Williams told me that everybody backed out, but maybe Mike Maples invested again. I don't know. Yeah. You're probably right. So the real important point there is that you kind of have to not judge one way or the other. This is going to succeed or this is going to fail. But it's important to try lots of things and get the skills of entrepreneurship, get the skills of executing. People always say ideas are a dime a dozen and execution's everything. But they forget that execution ideas are a subset of ideas. You have to really, some people execute well, some people execute poorly. So you have to have lots of ideas, and you have to really learn through experimentation on your ideas. You have to really learn how to execute. So Ev Williams was smart in allowing people to try different ideas, not being beholden, like, this has to work. I know it will work. We don't know anything. You have to really be humble in entrepreneurship and a new technology. And he said, okay, this one's not working, so we're going to do this one. And then none of the investors, except for maybe Maples, none of the investors believed it. So you kind of have to really understand how new technology that's on the edge, whether it's technically on the edge or culturally on the edge or whatever, you have to understand how the history of these things. Nobody believes it's going to work at first. That's why nobody ever did it before. And it takes a long time, not as long as it used to, but it takes a long time for technologies to be widely accepted and then monetized. And we just don't know. You don't know what people are going to have a demand for. And there's a really good reason for this. It's because you fill your day 24 hours a day with activities. Well, if I make something called Twitter, I'm saying you now have to switch doing one of your activities that you're used to doing to now using my product that I made. I don't know if you're going to do that, if people are going to mass make that choice to basically take a part of their day and start doing this thing that I created. So it's a big leap of faith, but you have to make those leaps. But at the same time, you have to reduce risk. So Ev Williams reduced risk by very quickly shutting down his podcasting software when he sensed it wasn't going to work and trying this thing that was relatively cheap to maintain so that he could afford to, you know, buy back the investors and invest in the development of this project. You look at Twitter, it's like a website that was made. You could tell it was a website that was made like 20 or 30 years ago or 15, whenever it was made. And you know, it's not rocket science. It's an easy to make website. So he didn't have to spend a lot of money. And, you know, it's understanding execution, entrepreneurship, the cycles of a new industry. Let's take solar power. Solar power, 10 years ago, I would have said, this is the worst industry. The government is totally subsidizing this entire industry. It's a bunch of losers are in it who care about, you know, they don't realize that oil is super cheap and is going to drive the world forever. But meanwhile, I didn't realize solar power is increasing. The power of solar power is increasing exponentially. So eventually it's going to be great. It's just like Bitcoin and crypto in general. The crypto world is increasing at an exponential rate, and it has been since 2009, since it first bought a pizza or whatever. The internet usage was increasing at an exponential rate in the 90s and the 00s. So there was no way it was going to fail. It's like in computers in 1966, every 18 months, Moore's Law, every 18 months, computing power would double. It's Moore's Law is still working. It's still doubling. So all these things, in an exponential business, you have to kind of have faith in the exponentiality of it and try lots of things and execute really well. I don't know if that was a too long an answer for your question, but and I don't know if I precisely answered it, but that's the way I go.
That's part of the fun. But when did you start to notice that the exponential nature of things was where technology was headed? Because did you know when you were making websites for AOL and HBO, did you know that the internet was an exponential function, or was that something you learned later on?
That's a really good question. I will say that is something I learned later on. What drove me, and it comes, the fact that I didn't know this is interesting, because my pitch to every company, like I'd visit a company and they would say, what's this web thing? Why do we need a website? And I said, sooner or later, every company on the planet is going to have a website and perhaps to sell their products through it or do customer service through it or whatever, a whole bunch of things. But I didn't say this is exponentially growing. I didn't know that. What I knew was that I loved it. I loved surfing the web. There's even so few websites then compared to now, but I loved surfing the web. I loved everything about it, even though there's none of the websites we have now. And I loved making pages, and I loved the creativity of it. And I honestly still thought it was going to be more of an artistic medium than a commercial medium. I didn't know it, but I did have a feeling every company was going to have a website. Like HBO didn't even own HBO.com. They had homeboxoffice.com. There was a company in Atlanta, Georgia, that was called HBO and Company. It was a medical supplies company, and they owned HBO.com. So I convinced HBO I think this was like late 1994, early 1995. I convinced them to buy the URL, HBO.com. Guess how much it cost them back then, 1994?
Probably like $100.
No, $250,000.
Oh, really? That much? HBO.com cost that much back then?
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought it would be like $100 too. I would be almost like, screw those people. Like, we could, home box office is fine. But I didn't know. And the CFO of HBO, who had no clue what the internet was even, he made a good decision. That's why I liked working at HBO, by the way. It's the only job I've ever had, because then I went off on my own. But they were a really well-run company, and so many people who worked there ended up being CEOs of other entertainment companies. It was just a great environment to work. And because of foresight like that, why would the CFO pay $250,000 for something he didn't understand? But he had the right intuition.
You mentioned before that you love the internet. And it seems like from an outsider's perspective, you've still maintained that love for the internet. I mean, I saw as recently as last year, you're posting on TikTok, and the way you post content, you've evolved with the internet, it seems like. So how do you think you've maintained that love for the internet, if that's actually correct from my external point of view?
I think I really, I remember when Facebook first launched, or, shortly after it launched, when they opened it up to not just students, and I started using it, and I had that same feeling again that, oh my God, this is great. Like, it was like I was an archaeologist of my life. Like, here's all my elementary school friends. I'm going to be Facebook friends with them now. I would never call up one of my classmates from second grade and say, hey, how'd your kid do in his soccer match today? Like, I would never do that. I'm never going to talk to them again. But it was great to see, oh, this is what this guy is like grown up, and here's his son and or daughter, and here's what they're doing. And so then there's my high school friends, and then my college friends, and then friends from graduate school and work and different subcultures that I've been involved in. It was like this archaeological dig on my life, every set of friends. And this was like an amazing thing to me. So I, at the time, I remember Facebook, I think it was Microsoft, offered Facebook $1 billion for their business. Mark Zuckerberg would have made $250 million. And he famously turned it down because he said, you know, well, what am I going to do with, I'm 24 years old, what am I going to do with $250 million? I'm just going to start another social network. So they turned it down. And I wrote an article that week, and it was in the Financial Times, saying he was smart because Facebook's eventually going to be worth $100 billion. And everyone thought I was just the biggest idiot. CNBC had me on, and they were laughing, and they kept playing a recording of Jeff Bezos's laugh. And everyone just thought I was ridiculous. And then 5 years later, on the day of the IPO, they were worth that day $100 billion. Not that I'm so prophetic, but when you get excited about something in this visceral way, you kind of have to trust it, that you're not the only one this excited. There's a reason that this is, you're feeling this primal giddiness about it. And I kind of trusted that more than any math about what's exponential. I still won't use solar power, but I'll use the internet.
You know, it's so crazy because I got chills when you're just talking, because that's exactly how I feel about NFTs. Like, oh,
I can tell because looking at your Twitter stream, you're totally excited about NFTs. Like you're just that excitement alone is going to bring you to the edge. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but go ahead.
No, I was going to say, when was the last time you personally felt that level of excitement and joy for something?
All the time. And it's a frustrating thing because you kind of have to follow it or else you're lost. Like if you're feeling that excitement about something, that, like, and by the way, that excitement makes money. Like, so after I wrote that article, I found I was going broke then. It was one of the many times I've gone broke in my life and after making a lot of money, but I was looking for any Facebook like agency, kind of like how I had a web agency. I was looking for what's the equivalent for Facebook, for not even social media, just for Facebook. And so I invested in every single one I could find because that's the business I sort of knew the best. And even if I was going broke, I would miss a mortgage payment so that I could invest in a private social media company. And those made a lot of money. I was a seed investor in Buddy Media. Buddy Media sold for like $800 million to Salesforce.com. I was in other similar companies. And so that following that call, whether it's financially and also in your activities of what you do and also in your activities of what you learn and the skills you try to develop, is really important. Like what if I was so scared about losing money? What if I said, just forget it. I'm not cut out for this entrepreneur stuff. I'm going to go and, I don't know, try to be a novelist or be an accountant or whatever. And I would feel depressed and lost. The problem is sometimes you're giddy and passionate about things that don't make money. So, you know, in 2015, I always do experiments in my life to see what I'm going to like, what I'm not going to like. So I went on stage and I did stand-up comedy for the first time in 2015. And it blew my mind. I got obsessed. And that's the main activity I did for the next 6 years, even through COVID. And, you know, as different states opened up, everybody told me, you can't do this. You're like a business guy, right? Why are you going to do stand-up comedy? That's stupid. And you're in your 40s. You're not going to succeed at this. You got to be in your teens to start this. So everyone, when you start doing something new, everyone, friends, family, associates, they're all going to tell you, Danny, what are you doing? Like, why don't you wait and see if this is going to be a thing or not? Don't waste all your time on this. You went to school for dentistry or whatever you did, like just focus on that, and then in your spare time, just for like on the weekends in your garage, you could play around with this stuff. So everyone was telling me you can't do this. Comedy never really made money for me, of course, because it doesn't make money for anyone, but I got good enough that I toured all around the world by the end of it, and now I don't really do it as much. I'm not as interested, so I follow my call. You have to follow your whatever is calling you, and that's how you develop as a human, because the path, what you're really talking about is the path to mastery. And to master something is a very beautiful thing because you learn something so deeply that you learn all the nuances and the artistry, and you can appreciate the difference between someone who's another master or a better master and someone who isn't as good but might be famous for whatever reason. And you could see in your own development, like, you become more creative and you become healthier and you build your community around you in all the different areas you're interested in. You could be interested in more than one thing at once as well. But I always just follow my interests. Unfortunately, sometimes they make money and sometimes they don't.
You know, what you just described hit me for the first time ever, that when you are pursuing a passion to mastery, to the level of mastery, it doesn't have to be a passion, but when you are pursuing mastery, you almost become one with that thing and attach yourself to it. And sometimes there's no difference, but in other people's eyes, between the thing of comedy and James Altucher, if you're really doing it at the highest level. Do you agree with that?
That's a really important concept. That is 100% correct. And this, by the way, this even works if you're working for a company and you like the company you're working for. I'll just use HBO as an example. I loved HBO shows. And so when I pitched the CEO to let me do my own web shows HBO style on the website, I felt comfortable using phrases like, we already do these original TV shows. We do this. Yeah. Let us now do this thing. And it would fit the brand. And, you know, he agreed. And I knew everything about the company. I loved it. And I think employees, to really grow at a company, you have to, you know, feel like you're speaking with, you know enough, and you love it enough, you're speaking with the voice of the company. The other thing that's really important about loving what you do and is particularly loving something that's worth mastering is that it takes a lot of energy to get good at something. And let's say you have two people. One doesn't love it and the other does love it. The one who doesn't love a domain or a skill or a topic or whatever, he has to put energy into convincing himself every day, okay, now I gotta write my novel. I want to be a famous novelist, but it's such a drag, so he's got to spend like at least 10% of his energy that day convincing himself just to do this thing. The person who loves the activity or the skill or whatever, he or she doesn't have to. He can use that energy doing the thing rather than convincing himself to do the thing. So the person who has the passion will always beat out the person without the passion. Assuming there's no such thing as talent, which is a big debate and argument, assuming that everybody starts off with a level playing field, the person with passion is going to learn more nuances, have more energy to really get deep into a topic. I would, if I didn't care about the internet, I never would have learned the skills. I just wouldn't have cared. And same thing now with crypto and NFTs. Same things with, you know, stand-up comedy or writing a book or investing. I was obsessed with investing for a while, and that was a real grueling trial by error. But the other thing about mastery of a domain is that it's not a happy thing. It's more about development of you as a human and your well-being. If I wanted to just be happy, I would just sit around and watch TV and eat popcorn all day. I love popcorn and I love watching sitcoms. And I would just do that all day. But when let's say you want to be a great tennis player and you love it, you're going to be miserable half the time because you're going to lose a lot. And losing, you care about because you love this so much and you want to get good. You're going to be so upset at yourself when you lose. So there's going to be this psychological component as well. And, you know, it's not pleasant to master something that's worth mastering because it's hard. And you have to know this also, the meta skill set of how to master something.
What was the most difficult?
Let's say you're mastering NFTs. Okay, yeah. Then the next thing is going to come on 5 years from now. Well, you'll master that area even faster because you'll know, you'll back up and say, well, this is what I did when I was mastering the skill set of NFTs. I did this, this, this. And you'll be able to say, okay, right away, I'm going to do this, this, this. You don't have to wait anymore. You know how to master something. So you learn that language of mastery to master the next thing.
Like you did with your putting money into the Facebook agencies because you had the experience with the web agency.
Right. Like, I wasn't necessarily a good investor back then. This was like in 2006 or something. But I did know if I thought Facebook was going to be a mini internet. Like it was going to be basically an organized internet. All the pages would look the same, and everybody was going to eventually gravitate from having. I was more extreme than what it ended up even happening. I thought everybody was going to gravitate to having a Facebook presence, and their web presence wouldn't matter as much. Which it was going in that direction, and it's sort of like half true. Every company does have a Facebook presence, and everybody does have a Facebook page. Probably people don't even have their own personal web pages as much anymore, but they definitely have a Facebook page. So I was more or less correct, and I was definitely correct when I applied it to investing. But, you know, again, you don't know for sure. You have to realize you don't know for sure. So I didn't like put my entire life savings in one company. I tried to diversify as much as possible and like as many companies as possible that were in that space. And, you know, some didn't work out, but most did.
When you look for investing, like you're going to give people money, obviously you had strong conviction in the entire area. But when you think about specific people and giving specific people money, are there particular traits that you look for?
I like to know that they have built and sold a company before. And both things are important. Built a company before because execution is difficult. Like, and again, I know people who are really poor at executing, they will never be able to start a company. And I know people who are really good at it, they could almost start anything and it'll work out. The other side of this though is it's very hard to sell a company. It's hard to start a company and it's hard to sell a company. So whenever I've invested in someone who's never really sold a company before, they just don't know what it is to like reach out and there's a whole language to selling a business. And it's hard to find acquirers. It's hard to negotiate. It's hard to extract the most value for your shareholders. It's hard to answer the question, why do you want to sell this business? Because the answer is, I want to get rich. And but you have to say other things, and they have to be true. So you have to constantly think of have a vision of what this looks like if you have a bigger partner and so on. So I like for someone who have started and sold a company. I also like it when other people smarter than me are investors. Whenever I was the only, like sometimes I'd see a company, this is great, and no one else knows about it. I'm gonna get a third of this company because I'll negotiate and whatever. Those companies always go out of business immediately. But like this Buddy Media example I told about before. Well, I like the space, but guess what? Peter Thiel, the first investor in Facebook, was also investing in the same round as me. So what, you know, am I going to argue with Peter Thiel, who was the first investor? Am I going to argue with him about a Facebook agency? I'll follow him into any deal pretty much, particularly about a Facebook deal. It's just like if Warren Buffett invests in IBM and you run into Warren Buffett at a cocktail party, you're not going to say, Warren, how could you be so stupid? IBM is not going to succeed in this new world. It's Warren Buffett. It's the best investor in history. You just put, here, Warren, here's my check. Just I'm going into IBM with you. So that's even how I do my stock market investing, which I rarely do. But I look for what great investors are in the company. If none are, then why would I have an edge? I'm sitting in a basement right now. Why would I have an edge over all the greatest investors in the world? Like I have to see smarter people in it in order for me to go in it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you've mentioned before also that you just put all your investing and startup investing to your friend Kamal Ravikant. So I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard on a podcast. And I
go for that's it. What I tell people when they pitch to me. So, oh, don't talk to me. Talk to Kamal. But but that's right. So I am invested in a lot of private companies, but now I don't really do that. Most of it's through Kamal's fund, and Kamal's a very good venture capital investor. He's very, very good.
Yeah, so I think you mentioned that you just didn't find joy from investing anymore. And
yeah,
I'm curious.
Zero.
And so I'm curious, when you do find enjoyment from doing something and then it stops, how do you identify that? And what does that feel like to you?
Okay, so 2015, I started doing comedy. And I started getting on stage more and more and more. And in New York City, I started performing like 5-6 nights a week, sometimes 2 or 3 shows a night. And meanwhile, during the day, I was doing my business activities, but I really loved comedy. I would watch comedy videos all day long. I would write ideas down for jokes. And then I started traveling around to other, like I got invited to do comedy at other clubs around the country and then even in Europe. And then it, as COVID was kind of going through its cycles in 2020, like I started doing comedy again in September and traveling around. And then suddenly some switch like flipped. And I just felt like, you know, my manager, I had a comedy manager, he would call up and say, do you want to do XYZ club? And it would be like the biggest club in New York City or LA or San Francisco. And I'm like, nah, I can't make it. And I just felt like it was a chore. And then I knew, what am I going to do? Just another notch in the belt to do at this club? I just stopped doing it and went on to the next thing. I had this experience. I learned an enormous amount. But it's like I do this every few years. So I know myself that once it's over, it's over.
Mm. And you also mentioned more recently that you stopped doing your ideas or you stopped progressing, in your own words, in a previous podcast, I believe, from July and for about 1 to 2 months. And I'm curious if that was COVID related or that was comedy related and how you got yourself out of that funk.
Yeah, good question. Good, you did good research. So I have very rarely ever been burnt out. Maybe I can remember in 1992, there was like a few months I was burnt out. And even when I've been really depressed, I always wanted to get things. Even when I went broke and got depressed and was scared of I was going to lose everything and lose my family, I still was like trying to make things happen in my life. But, you know, I wrote this article a year ago, a little over a year ago now, a year and 2 months ago. It was about, I'm a New Yorker, born and raised all around that area. I lived there all my life, except when I went to school. And my kids live there. My whole family's there. And I love New York. And I've had such great experiences there. And I saw that there were problems other than COVID that were happening in New York because of the economic lockdowns. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't have been. I don't care about the politics of all this. But business owners were suffering. I was a local business owner. I owned a comedy club. And I was going to all the GoFundMes of all the different restaurants in my area, and the employees were struggling, and business owners were struggling. Violence was shooting up. There was garbage in the streets. I was holding fundraisers for candidates in New York. Like, I really care about the city. So, but I felt people were in denial. Everyone was like, oh, no, when there's a vaccine, New York's going to go straight back to what it was. And I'm like, how could that be if one-third of the small businesses in the city are out of business? Like, that's happening. Like, if you go drive down Broadway in New York City right now, 1 out of 3 businesses are permanently boarded up. They're shut down. Some of my favorite places are shut down. And it's not just like, you know, most of the time I've lived in New York, I've been like dirt poor. And so it's not like fancy places. These were hardworking people, and they weren't chains or big companies. And meanwhile, again, there was crime. There was, you know, I saw that people were leaving. So the tax, what's going to happen when you have an expensive city to support and the entire tax base leaves? Like, people don't really understand economically how that turns into a death spiral. If New York City has no revenues from taxes, it'll offer less services. Less people will move there. More people will move out, which means even less revenues, which means even less services. So it becomes a death cycle, a death spiral. And so I wrote an article, New York City is Dead Forever. Here's why. An aggressive title, but I was worried people were in denial about these real problems. And by the way, the mayoral candidates knew those problems were there. I talked to almost all of them afterwards and even before. They were aware of the problems. That's what all their debates were about. But anyway, I got an enormous, it was my most viral article ever. Maybe 30 million people read the article or read the article, because a lot of people read it on their podcasts out loud or on their radio shows, like Rush Limbaugh read it and on his show word for word. And I don't know him at all, or didn't know him at all, but he did it. Joe Rogan talked about it on his podcast. I don't know Joe. And so 30 million people read it, and like with anything, maybe 2 or 3% are going to hate it. But 3% of 30 million is a million people, and all million of them felt the need to contact me and make death threats and insult me in all sorts of various ways. My comedy club was vandalized. My coworkers were harassed in the street and were assaulted. And it's here. It is a year and 2 months later, still pretty much almost every day on social media, someone trashes me because of this article, and then they'll throw up some stupid statistic that is meaningless because statistics could be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And meanwhile, I supported and I'm good friends with Eric Adams, who's going to be the next mayor of the city. And when I say good friends, like, he's over my house for Thanksgiving and I hold a fundraiser for him. And people are aware of the problems. Like, smart people are aware of the problems, and they're difficult. But I still got all this hate. And not only did I get hate from strangers, I saw that people that I had known or helped over the decades, whether they were, you know, ex-employees or family members or people I had lost touch with, they were trashing me also. And not all, like, some of them were like showing their true colors. And I got kind of disturbed. And then Jerry Seinfeld came out and wrote an entire one-page column in the New York Times where he didn't address any of the issues and just was personally insulting me. And I kept saying, the newscasters wanted to talk to me, and I kept saying, look, as long as he's addressing the issues, that's great. I don't care if he disagrees with me, but let's solve the problems. Don't just insult me. But that wasn't happening. People still to this day are trashing me every day. But I think for a few months, something in my brain switched off and said, look, I know you've had personal attacks against you many times before, but this is the worst we've ever seen here in your brain, and you need to shut it down for a while. And so I did. Like, you have to listen to the calling and, you know, and go where it takes you. And so I stopped for a while and still kind of stopped because I've sort of been pursuing other things. But this is the first time since 1991 that I haven't been writing every single day. I think that, and people always say, oh, I don't care what the haters think. You have to not care. They're always lying when they say that. You always care a little bit. Now, particularly when a million people, and people also you were close to at one point, when they're trashing you, it's a drag. And I would write articles that other people would hate, and I could learn how to handle it over time. But this was just far bigger than I'd ever handled before, and I think it affected me.
Humans aren't built to be excommunicated from their tribe, and that is something that we can't fathom. And then if it happens on the scale of a million people, it's like our brain doesn't even know how to process that because it can't even process a million people to begin with. So
right. And yeah. I'm not exaggerating with the million. It was literally like a million people. And again, I know 30 million people. I know how many people read the article and or were exposed to it. So it was about only 3 or 4%. But it was a big number, and there were some personal attacks, like a lot, and there was attacks against people that I know, and there was just a lot of weirdness around it. Meanwhile, I also had a lot of people call, like big people calling me and saying I should run for mayor, but I didn't want to do that, and I really think Eric Adams, who's going to be the mayor now, is a really great choice. But yeah, I think about once a year I have faced haters before, maybe more than once a year, but I could always handle it. Even when I first was writing about crypto, a lot of haters, but I could handle it. It wasn't that big a deal, and I didn't get burnt out. But this time, you know, I don't know. I still do my business activities, but I got interested in, you know, I guess the TV show The Queen's Gambit was coming out, and I got interested in just getting better at, like, mastering, using all my skills of how to master something, mastering chess. And I already was a chess master as a kid, but, you know, if you don't do something for 25 years, you lose some of the skills. So I've said to myself, okay, I'm going to use all these techniques that I had just written about. I'm going to apply it to, I'll get the best I've ever been at this game that I love doing. And that's what I've done. So,
and Has that made you feel less burnt out or given you more joy? Or do you still hold a bit of that from that period of time?
I guess I still hold a little bit of it because I just don't understand why some people did some things. But it has given me a lot of joy, and it's a very creative, interesting game, and it's given me lots of ideas, and there's lots of analogies between not necessarily chess and life, but learning chess and life. And, you know, I try not to let things slip too much in my other activities, particularly the ones that, you know, other people depend on, like employees and things like that. And, so far, so good. And I played in my very first tournament in 24 years last Saturday. I came in first.
Congrats.
And I have a huge tournament coming up next week in Washington, D.C., so I'm preparing for that. And then we'll see. We'll see where it goes. I'm just following the calling. And amazing things happen, by the way, when you do that. Like, I've now, the main chess magazine in the world has asked me to write for them, and I've been on, you know, all, contact with all these, like, really great players who were my heroes as a kid. So it's just amazing what happens when you really dive into an interest and pursue mastery in it.
It's amazing, and I love to hear it. I want to stay on the topic of just haters or the excommunication, because I heard in a previous podcast you did that your family got so upset with you that they never spoke to you again based only on the things that you wrote. And
yeah,
this really struck me because I really just felt bad and just my heart hurt for you. So take me through that relationship and like if that's mended at all and how you dealt with that.
Yeah, and it's not just one relationship, it's a couple. And I should mention most of my family, the family that's important to me is my wife and my children. They're, you know, that there's no problem there. But it's like, you know, other family members. And I just would never understand it. Like, but I think it's sort of like the thing, like, let's say you're in a relationship, like, with a girl, and suddenly she starts acting weird, and she breaks up with you, and whatever. And you want to understand why. You really can never ask the question why. There is no answer to that question. And that's the question we always want to answer because, like you say, we're tribal animals. So to get, you know, for 200,000 years, if a human was kicked out of the tribe, that almost meant certain death because you would be on your own in the forest and will be eaten by animals or killed by other tribes. Like most people died a violent death back then. And so we have this primal fear of being kicked out of the tribe, and family is your tribe. But and when someone excommunicates you, you want to know why, because it might mean life or death. But there's no answer to that question. Like one time I was going out with somebody who I only later learned was severely bipolar, and then she did all sorts of weird things and just disappeared, and then wanted to get back to, yeah, it was a whole thing. But and I would always try to understand why, and that's when I really realized there's never going to be an answer to that question. And it's the same case with these relations. You don't, even if someone's a stranger and like insults me on Twitter, I don't know what's going on in their life. Maybe they had just bought an apartment in New York, and then they got laid off from their job, and they got scared when they read my article. And so rather than deal with their own fear, they got angry at me. Anger is often fear clothed. And so a lot of the times when people are angry at you, they're really just afraid for themselves. And it's a cliche to say it's not about you, it's about them. But in many cases, that's the truth. And so I would intellectually tell myself that. Like, let's say I've been right. Let's say one person is a writer, but she never was able to publish. And I've published 25 books. Now I write something that goes against what he or she thinks, and it's like, you know, you can't write that. I'm never going to talk to you again. Well, again, I could tell myself, oh, perhaps this person's jealous, or because I don't really think I wrote anything harmful, and you know, it's weird if you don't even want to have a conversation. But you can't ask why is this happening, even though you really want to. So that's part of the dissonance that you feel. Like it hurts and it's harmful, but you have to just move on. You can't, there's nothing you can do. You can't ask why, and you can't try to be nice to someone to get them to like you. Like, that's not how it works. So, but I think when enough of these things happen at the same time, which is what happened to me with this article, like, everybody used it as an excuse to pivot their feelings for me. So some people loved me and reaffirmed their friendship with me, and other people used it as an opportunity to trash me. So I had two ex-girlfriends write articles about me. So after this. So, and I'm like, what? And it was filled with like non-truths because I didn't haven't even seen them in years. And so it was just this weird thing.
They need to get the anger.
That whole experience was weird.
Yeah. And it leads me to think about a quote that you wrote in, I believe, your latest book, which might not have been your latest book, but you'll tell me if you remember. But it's, the only real fire to cultivate is the fire inside of you. Nothing external will cultivate it. The greater your internal fire is, the more people will want it. They will smoke every drug lit by your fire. They will try to ignite their own fires. They will try to light up their own dark caves. The universe will bend to you. So it's like, to go from that place of so much negativity coming at you, you really need to light up your own fire, is what I took from this.
Yeah. And usually, in 100% of cases, even when I had massive haters over something else, like, and I've always had it. Even when, like, in 2005, I wrote an article, nobody should buy a home. I got a lot of haters. Or I wrote an article once, I don't know, it doesn't even matter. But I've had, about once a year, I've had an article that always reflects what I believe in, but ignites haters. And I've always been able to deal with it by being enthusiastic about what I'm doing, being excited about it, having that passion and that giddiness for what I love. And this time it was so much energy to try to drown me out that I don't think I've quite lit that fire back in the same way. Now I have for the things I'm interested in, but they're a little bit more, you know, solo, these things. Like playing chess is a solo, you know, pretty much solo activity. It's not like something, it's not like I write an article about it and it goes to a billion people. So I think I kind of just mentally, I wanted to keep growing, but I switched to something where the truth, it works. Like, you only win a game if you're better, if you're the better player and you have the better ideas than the other person. And that's a truth. And none of this arguing on Twitter or about, like, you know, all the false facts and info or hatred that people send to me. And again, the people who liked, the 29 million people who liked or appreciated the article, they're normal people and they went back to their normal lives. But the million haters, the 3%, they just are insane. So, and I'm left to deal with it.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because I remember talking to my family about it, and we're all New Yorkers, and we were all like, I disagree for this reason, I agree for this reason, but none of us that I know of went to our laptop, sent you a message, and started to go on Twitter saying how wrong you were. You know what I mean? So it's like one thing to disagree with something, it's another thing to disagree and then try to make someone else's day worse because of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I repeatedly say in the article, I love New York. I don't, these are problems that I'm seeing, and I've quoted sources for each problem, so it wasn't like a mystery. And other articles have since, you know, repeated the problems, and some of them have gotten worse. And I was only wrote it because I was worried everybody was in denial. And again, like, you know, normal human beings who are sane could agree or disagree, and that's where conversation starts, and that's how solution, that's how democracy works, and that's how solution happens, and that's how innovation happens. You know, I have a business partner since 1999, and we've been through ups and downs of huge amounts together. And I'm pro-choice, he's pro-life, and we have discussions about it. We've never once had an argument about it. In fact, we've had disagreements. We've never gotten angry at each other because we're dealing with a lot of money together, and we have families that we want to support, and we also know how to converse and not be like an animal. So
yeah, how has this cloud affected your podcasting or more creative pursuits? You said you stopped writing as much, but what about podcasting?
Yeah, I don't think it's affected my podcasting as much because I really do like meeting you know, my heroes over the decades and interviewing them and talking to them. I would say probably, though, like I was up to doing like 8 shows a week. So now I'm doing like 3. So I guess it's affected it a little bit, like definitely. But I think the quality, I think the experience in itself has deepened me and made me more sympathetic to other people's, you know, ups and downs in that way. And so I think my podcast has gotten much better, but it's affected a little. It's affected the quantity, certainly. So
how
you know, I spend a lot, the time I would have spent in the morning writing, it's not like I've stopped writing completely, but usually those mornings now I'll study chess and get better at chess. Like I love doing that. That's what's calling me.
I love it. And how do you measure progress? This is a question that I'm so curious to get your answer on, because you've done so many different creative pursuits. How do you measure that you're progressing in something creative?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question, because let's take writing as an example. So as I started getting more and more, as my articles, I should say, started getting more and more read, I thought the right metric was number of views. But that's not necessarily the case, because I noticed for myself, the articles that I felt the best about would get the lowest views. Like I would write something and I'm like, damn, that's good. That 1 out of 50 that I wrote, that's a good one. It'll get like no views. And then something that's like, you know, 10 ways to succeed as an entrepreneur, which I wasn't as, you know, it's kind of almost a cliche topic. And I don't think I wrote an article with that title, but let's say that title. It's not going to be like a work of literature, but those, of course, would get the most views. And, you know, I like the nuances of writing, so I appreciate more when I do something I think is creatively good. But, you know, some metrics are that you have to kind of pick and choose your metrics. And sometimes the metric of views is important, particularly if it's related to something I'm doing business about. And sometimes it's just how you feel, like this is good. That is an important metric. And in business, your metric is, are you getting customers? Are you getting more customers this month than last month? For the podcast, are you getting more downloads or whatever? Or downloads is tricky, because the algorithms change all the time about what a download is measured at, and you have to make sure you're up on what the latest algorithms are for counting downloads. But is my listenership more or less than last month? If something's kind of just steady or declining for a while, it might mean you have to change the format or change something or just stop doing it, move on to something else. So if something's not working, after a while, you have to quit. Otherwise, you're wasting your time.
But what if you love it?
So if you love it, you're not going to... Love is a virtuous cycle also, in that, like, you don't want... Your love has to be requited. If you're going for the same girl and she's not returning your passion for her, then you have to quit. So and find someone else to love, because you don't want to be in a situation where there's unrequited love. And everything we do, if podcasts, it's unrequited love if your listeners are going down, if you don't have any listeners. And so your love will go down as well if it's unrequited. So that's something that's true too. That if the internet didn't become a big thing, I would have lost my interest in it. But it was clearly becoming big, so I doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down right in the beginning on it.
Yeah, it's interesting, because you've said, I think before, that it was 10 or 11 years before you ever made money from your writing. Is that correct?
Yeah, I started writing every single day in 1990. I was thrown out of graduate school in 1991 because I was writing all the time and not attending class. And my first published piece of writing was in December of 2002. So, and I was writing every single day that entire time. And then I wrote every single day from 2002 until like, you know, August of last year.
Was that unrequited love, though, for the 10 years that you weren't making money or you didn't publish?
No, because, and I was trying to publish, but I didn't measure I measured whether I felt like I was getting better or not. And that was like an internal feeling, like, oh, I feel really good. I would feel like, oh, this story, I write like fiction. So I would feel like, oh, this short story is really an improvement on where I was a year ago. And you know, and by the way, and sometimes I would get like, when I was working at HBO and doing this 3 a.m. project, a lot of it was, I was writing. So I would get feedback oh, that's really good. I would get feedback, even though I wasn't getting paid for that writing specifically. I was an employee, so I was just getting my salary. But I would get feedback along the way, but just different from just getting paid or getting, you know, large numbers of viewers. And again, large numbers of viewers or readers is not necessarily the best metric. I'd rather write a good short story than another New York City is Dead Forever article. So,
do you regret publishing that, or are you happy you did at this current juncture?
I definitely regret publishing it. And people always, that's another thing. People always say, oh, you should never have regrets, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I try never to have regrets. I've gone broke and lost all my money repeatedly. And, you know, I try not to regret that because it made me a better person in a lot of ways. And I'm with my current wife and family because of all of that. And I'm in a good, and it made me a better investor, much better investor, learning from my mistakes. So I don't really regret that, although I did at the time. But, you know, just an article causing so much anguish, and I don't know if it'll solve any of the problems in New York. Now, I was able to have really great discussions with, you know, people who could make change in New York City and help with the problems. So maybe it'll make a difference. But in general, it has not been a positive for me, and I would say I definitely regret it. And by the way, I don't think it was a mistake to write it. That's not what the article was correct, and millions of people agree with it. But it definitely, the negative effect it had on my life, which ultimately I could deal with, I still regret it.
Well, I hope that you find some level of something positive happens only as a result of you writing that article that you could never have predicted otherwise. That's the type of mindset that I try to have with events like that happen in my own life. But
yeah, I think probably I needed to slow down a little bit. And I definitely think there are positive things that are coming out of it. And, you know, I'm a much better chess player right now than I ever was before in my life. So, you know, and my podcast, because I'm doing fewer episodes, I'm able to focus more on each episode. And it gave me a lot of insight into, even though I've written a lot about people and, you know, trying to figure people out and stuff, I think this gave me a different kind of insight into people and really confirmed for me the, you know, you can't ever ask why someone is doing something that might be harmful to you or seems strange to you. Like you have to really train yourself to move on and you have to try to not let it phase you. I think, you know, trying is better than not doing anything at all. So yeah, I think the net result will be positive. Just definitely at the time it was enough to just really burn me out. And then the Seinfeld thing, like Seinfeld was a hero of mine. I was a comedian. Mm. So I don't know why he's never written an op-ed in his entire life. And you could, you know, he didn't even address any of the issues. So that disturbed me. That disturbed me a little bit.
What do you think James 3 years from now would tell you about what you're going through right now?
He'll probably say it was for the best. And it probably is. It's just like some mornings I wake up and I am thinking, why did that person tweet that thing last night? It's like a year and 2 months later. Can't they relax yet? And it would be like famous people sometimes. Or it would be people I knew like 20 years ago and not acknowledging that we were like good friends then and whatever. Maybe life didn't work out for them in some ways. And so now they're taking it out on me. But I don't know. I can't ask why. But so sometimes I'll wake up thinking about it. Like, why did that person do that? But most of the time I then tell myself like, okay, just move on. What do I have to do today? And do things that I love, keep physically fit and sleep 8 hours a day and have a good diet and make sure this whatever's happening on Twitter doesn't affect my relationships with my wife and my kids and my friends and my community and so on, and still try to be creative every day, like write down 10 ideas a day, and as best as you can, try not to regret or feel anxious. But that, you know, all of those things are difficult.
Yeah, well, what I've always appreciated about you from the outside is your absolute vulnerability of just saying the truth of what you felt in any given moment. And I think that's why your writing connects so deeply, is because you've said before that you don't publish something unless it really hits you, or you might be embarrassed to publish it. And that always stayed with me at such a deep level. And this is, and really you talking important. Openly about this in this conversation is the same idea, just in an audio form.
It's a really important concept, because let's say you write something and you're not afraid to publish it. Probably means you didn't write something interesting, and you didn't write something unique or that people really want to read. And you have to be all those things. Now, you don't write something just to be provocative. Right. Sometimes people think I wrote that, just to be provocative. No, it was something I was deeply feeling, which is why the writing was good enough that it went so viral. Other people were writing similar things, but their writing was no good. So unfortunately, mine went viral. And, but it's interesting, though, because I asked myself, I always ask the question, I asked myself right before I hit publish on that article, it was like August 13th, 2020, I remember exactly where I was sitting in my home and about to hit publish, and I look away from the article and I'm thinking, what am I afraid of to hit publish here? I wasn't afraid that it was going to go viral, because that's a rare thing. I was afraid, this was the first article where I presented problems where I didn't really understand what the solutions were going to be. And so I didn't offer a ray of hope at the end. And I'm a very optimistic person. And this one, I saw these problems, but I didn't know what the solutions would be, because they seemed really deep, like deep problems. And so I was afraid people would be sad because I wasn't offering a ray of hope at the end with some possible solutions, or despite all this, here's what I see happening like 3-4 years from now. I just didn't have that. Normally I have that. And so that's what I was afraid of, and that is probably the fear that made it viral.
Well, on that optimism front, I think that's something that we have in common, and just you see it so clearly in how you answer things and how you treat the world is with an optimistic frame of mind. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, let me ask you, like, what traits... do you see yourself as an optimist?
Absolutely.
And like, which of your parents maybe were optimists, or both of them were, or maybe neither of them were?
My mom, maybe.
Yeah. So I think we're kind of a combination of what we grow up with. And so like, my dad was like an extreme optimist, and my mom was an extreme pessimist. They split the difference. So if my dad said like one time I was 21 years old, I had just been thrown out of graduate school, and I had to get a little consulting job to make ends meet, and they wanted to pay me like $12.50 an hour, and my dad's like, no, you should ask for $90 an hour, and like, I'm not, they want to pay $12.50 an hour, how am I going to negotiate up to $90 an hour? Maybe I'll get $12.75. And he was an extreme optimist to the point of foolishness, and my mom was an extreme pessimist to the point of foolishness, and I probably got it from, I'm not to the point of foolishness, I think I'm a realist, but it's definitely better to be optimistic than pessimistic, because otherwise you'll never try things. Now, once you're an optimist about something, then you have to be pessimistic. So let's say I'm an optimist about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. So now I'm going to make an investment. Well, now my job is my only job is to be a pessimist. Like, you have to reduce the entire job of an investor after the initial decision that this looks good. Your entire job is to reduce risk. And entrepreneurs, investors are not risk takers. They're risk mitigators. So I know that investing is a path to wealth. I know that starting a company is a path to wealth. No one has to convince me. Now, I'm optimistic. I can do it. But okay, done. Now I'm going to start a business. I've got to just reduce risk. And so then you have to ask, what's the worst case scenario? What could go wrong? What's the worst case scenario? So you have to be very realistic. And so for my life, I'm optimistic that things move forward. You know, despite my brush with this past year, which maybe tipped me a little towards pessimism, but in general, it goes back to the beginning of this podcast. I was optimistic I could go to the CEO of HBO. My title was junior analyst programmer in the IT department. And I went to the CEO because, you know, I was optimistic nothing bad would happen. And you kind of have to have, if you have ideas and a vision for something, you have to believe in it, that it's calling you to do things. And I always surrender to that. And that's a form of optimism.
Well, I think that's a beautiful place to come to a close. I appreciate your vulnerability, your truth, your ability to put yourself out there time and time and time again. You have a huge fan of me, and I'm incredibly grateful for your presence on this podcast. Thank you, James, for coming here.
Well, and Danny, thank you so much for having me on. And I could see with you, like, you're creating, like, kind of a whole community around you. Like, it's like almost like a halo effect. Like, you're so excited about what you do that I see it. Everybody else around you in concentric circles gets excited about what you're doing and is happy for your happiness. And so I think that's a great skill to have and to cultivate. And I hope everyone, if anybody gets anything from this, I hope they get from you in all of your podcasts, this kind of excitement for what you're doing.
The excitement comes from reading people like you and consuming your content. So it's just a matter of a mirror. And so I'm very appreciative of the words. And where Thank should you. We direct people to send you some kind comments about what they thought about this episode?
Well, I don't know if you have a comment section in your website. I don't, just Google me and they could and they'll find me. Like, there's both the good, the bad, and the ugly. The ugly is in the images part, but the bad's in the news part, and the good's like on my websites or whatever.
No, all of it's good. All of it's good. Thank you, James, for coming on. I really appreciate you.
Thanks, Danny.
Thank you, as always, for listening into this point of the episode. You are so appreciated. I really appreciate you for listening, and I'm so grateful for you listening. So if you got to this point, shoot me a message on Twitter, at @HeyDannyMiranda. Just want to hear from you, your thoughts, and your feedback about this episode. That would mean the world to me, and I will see you in the next episode. Peace.